the Honourable the Minister for Employment, Enterprise and Diverse Other Responsibilities.
Speaker, in my budget speech last year, I made very clear a number of objectives, the principal one of which was increasing the number of devotarians in full-time employment. As I stated in the viewpoint program in November last year, based on the records of the employment service, the increase in the number of devotarians in employment in 1 year was going to exceed that which had taken place in the previous 15 years of GSD government. This has now been confirmed. In 1996, the GSD said the big issue was employment and argued that the registered unemployed at 331 in May of that year failed to reflect the numbers without a doubt. Had they been right, this would have then been reflected in ever increasing numbers of devotarians in employment, irrespective of whether the numbers that were registered for work, like looking for work, went down or not. This did not happen then, but has happened now. It is the hidden long term unemployed that we are reaching out to, because the real numbers without work was much greater than in 2011. We have registered with the Employment Service, and even now, we have not yet found work for all of them. The approach adopted has been a logical one, of looking to those sectors where the devotarian share of jobs was low or declining. The construction sector of the economy has been identified as a priority area to promote opportunities for devotarians and other residents, as I made clear a year ago. For many years, we pressed the previous government to take action to ensure that the unemployed persons had the opportunity to get their jobs, and for many years they argued that it was impossible because the Bulgarians did not want to work in the construction sector. Having long been in a denial mode about the takeover of the construction sector by imported labour, shortly before the last election, the government relented and introduced a system of allocation of construction contracts to local funds on condition that they employ persons supplied by the Employment Service. We supported this initiative and have, since December 2011, relied on its terms to ensure that approved contractors increase the use of local labor. I am glad to report that the success of the strategy is already reflected in the composition of the industry in the first year, based on the service report comparing October 2011 with October 2012. In this period, the total number of jobs in the industry fell as a result of the completion of a pre-election construction boom, which had drawn in many hundreds of outside workers, but was not reflected in higher local employment in the industry, in spite of the restriction placed on building firms in the last year, 2010-2011. In fact, 2011 saw the highest influx of new construction workers ever in the industry, which is partly explained by the concentration of construction projects in that period carried out by outside contractors. The total employment in the industry was 3,434 in October 2011, compared to 2,486 in October 2007, at the start of the previous term of office of the GSD, almost 1,000 more jobs, only 3 of which were taken up by devotarians, whose employment in the industry went up from 725 in 2007 to 728 in 2011, 3 more devotarians in the whole of the 4-year term of the last administration. In the year 11-12, the total number of jobs in the industry fell from 3,434 to 2008, a drop of 1,426. However, the jobs taken up by devotarians went up by 140 to 868. Here we go back to October 1996, when the DSC first came into office, and before the start of the process of encouraging the inflow of frontier workers into the industry, the figure for the construction industry was a total of 1,408, of which 752 were Gibraltarians. In just 1 year, we have been able to reverse the trend of the previous 15 years, and I expect this year's figure for the 2013 will show further improvement in the area based on the records of the employment service to date. It is quite incredible that in 15 years in government under the DSD, the number of jobs went up by over 2,000 in the industry, and the number of Gibraltarian construction workers went down by 26. Coming to the future job strategy, Mr. Speaker, I can report this year that today it has been much more successful in getting Gibraltarians into jobs than its predecessor team ever did in the preceding 15 years. Let me remind the House that the new approach to employment training was introduced as promised in the manifesto on the 1st of February 2012. In the first month, 5 employers signed up, committing themselves to provide employment at the end of the agreed training period, which initially was up to 11 months. In fact, since the month of February 2012 was the first month trial period, no employer had an obligation to sign up until March. However, this did not prevent the Honourable Mr. Fulton standing up and asking me to admit that the policy was a failure, because first the employers had signed up to it in its first month. By the end of the 11th month, in December 2012, 101 persons had completed their agreed training and started work by January 2013. Mr. Fulton's reaction now was to say that it was no more successful than its predecessor, the low-paid BTS. He argued this based on a claim that he and Mr. Montiel had carried out an exercise which showed that 101 was also the number taken on into permanent employment at the end of their time in the BTS scheme placement. He wanted me now to explain my failure to do better than Mr. Montiel. Couldn't say that the scheme was a failure anymore. His good friend, so he said at the time. Well, I have found no evidence in the department that any such practices have been done by him and his good friend. And if they did succeed in employing 101 persons, it certainly was not reflected in the 2011 employment survey report as an increase in the number of Gibraltarians in employment. However, what I'm now able to tell honorable members is that the results today trace a continuation of the trend established by the figures of January 2013, and as I've been providing in answer to questions on a regular basis, the take up on completion of training is very high and well above the success rate he claimed for those on the old BTS, which he told us was 28%. I have no reason to doubt that this will continue to be the case into the future. That is our success rate, not his 28%. I have said before that although opposition members have protested how much they want our policy to succeed, as they should, if they really care about the well-being of our people and the success of our economy, their constant prediction of failure and criticism of its effectiveness suggests the very opposite. Their prediction of failure and fault-finding is an indication that what they want is for the policy to fail, putting their own partisan political interests before the welfare of the unemployed who are being given an opportunity to go into jobs that previously were not open to them. I can tell the most one thing. It may not be perfect, and it may not work 100%, but it is hugely better than anything that was there before, and the result will continue to prove it. There are two issues I want to make clear that are being used by members opposite in order to try and undermine the training program. It is not the case that when vacancies are open and applications invited for the public service, trainees have any advantage in the selection process for those public sector jobs. The selection is done by interview boards on the basis of the merit of the applicant using their judgment. The result of at the Russian selection of railways clearly stated the vast majority who were selected were already employed in the private sector. Nor is it the case that persons in the private sector employment cannot get a job in the public or in other private sector vacancies because your employment service stops them. This is utter and complete nonsense. And again, my answer to questions recently has shown that the numbers getting employed in both the public and the private sector vacancies exceed by far the numbers who do so as a result of having their names submitted by the employment service, which sometimes seems to be a disadvantage or an advantage. However, the employment service exists to assist the unemployed into jobs, not to help those already in employment to get promotion, move to a better job, or one that they find more attractive. That has always been the role, and that is its role in any other country that puts a registered or unemployed person. The position today is therefore no different from what it has been before and from what it is everywhere else. Looking at the level of economic activity, Mr. Speaker, the number of employers in October 2012 who completed a survey return was 1,500 and increased by 55 from 2011, when the figure was 1,445. This is from the internal analysis of the Statistics Office discussed by sector. In the construction sector, however, there was a decline of 16 from 131 in 2011 to 115 in 2012. The leader of the opposition at question time last week claimed that there was an anomaly in that there had been a reduction in the number of construction workers shown in the survey report, whereas at the same time the number of employers had grown by 100. I have no idea where he got this information from, but it is totally incorrect as far as the statistics collected from the employment survey are concerned. If we exclude construction and wholesale and retail, where the number of returns fell slightly from 337 to 335, the rest of the economy reflected a rise in employer returns of 73. From 977 to 1050, around 8%. Let us compare this result with what is happening in the supposed economic boom of 2011, generated by a totally misguided pre-election spending spree. The October 11th survey provides us with a clear picture of where the economic activity was taking place. The number of employer returns in 2011 compared to 2010 was up by 11 from 116 to 127, almost 10%, in the construction sector, and down by 7 in the rest of the economy, which showed a reduction in the number of employer returns. This indicates little or no growth outside the construction activity, which activity, as we all know, was funded by public spending and caused a monumental influx of frontier workers, which, as I pointed out at the time, was an all-time record, leading to an outflow from our economy of much of the public money spent. The creation of this temporary construction job, taken up by the frontier workers, came at a price of over £100 million increase in the level of net debt. The debt which we have been told is what really counts, and which still remains to be significantly reduced. The leader of the opposition, when he was contesting the 203 election against the DUP, was horrified at the fact that the total outstanding gross debt was £100 million. Indeed, he got quite an odd move in the radio debate because I disagreed with him and agreed with the then chief minister that £100 million gross debt was not too high. That was, of course, when he was claiming that I was content to allow Mr. Carrana, as he then was, to remain in power, where he was determined to remove him, which he has now done, of course, albeit in an unusual manner. This is not the only U-turn by the member opposite, whose favorite pastime is to accuse me of making U-turns. For example, the horror he felt at 100 million gross debt was converted after 2007 into the view that the level of grace does not matter at all, however high. How can anyone reconcile with the speaker concern about total debt of 100 million and defend not long after of an increase of 100 million in net debt in 1 year old? An all-time record in debt increase to finance a pre-election boom that failed to gain the DSG and return to government, an expensive election campaign financed by the taxpayer. The answer, of course, is that it cannot be reconciled, because it is not a position that results from an analysis of what is sound policy to adopt on the public finances, but a position which is determined by a value judgment as to where not the greatest propaganda effect of the honorable member's reading. Since that is the hallmark of the honorable member's political philosophy, and presumably the new dogma of the GSB under his leadership, emulated by others on the opposition benches, there is a clear conclusion to be drawn. Explanations given in this parliament, however excessive or detailed, providing statistical evidence of what is happening in the economy or the labor market, will have no effect whatsoever on how the members opposite react and the political stand that they will adopt. Nothing could provide greater proof of this than the reaction to the evidence contained in the return provided by employers in Gibraltar and reflected in the report of the October 2012 survey. An increase of 524 in the number of Gibraltarians in employment is not something to be welcomed by them. Well, I assume the 524 families will now have an income earner contributing to the household, which is not the case in 2011, and we have taken careful note of that. The fact that it is the highest near-run number of Gibraltarians in employment is not important to the members of office. Instead, the propaganda is that there are now more Gibraltarians without a job than in 2011. How can that be, Mr. Speaker? Is it that I can perform miracles? That they left 500 unemployed? I have increased the numbers in employment by 524, and I'm still left with 500 unemployed. Where is it that I have produced 524 at my least, I have my three, or is it that the real number of unemployed in 2011 was in excess of 1,000? As the honorable member opposite admitted during the November election campaign, when he said employing all the jobless at the minimum wage would cost 11 million a year. That is the cost of 1,100 individuals at 10,000 a year. 1,100 unemployed workers, of whom 500 or less were registered and turning up regularly at the employment service, and therefore the rest were being either removed as left or failing to vote. One factor in the number registered not being higher has been the competition from the influx of frontier workers, encouraged and welcomed by the previous administration. This means that a considerable number of the jobs were actually filled before they were registered and available to the employment service, making it difficult for the staff at the employment offices to satisfy the demand for work from those coming up, and leading to many people eventually failing to go there to seek employment because it was considered a complete waste of time. I would like to deal now with the comment by the Honorable Mr. Figueroa, for which I am grateful. I have noted that he is concerned that I am over-protective in my efforts to get jobs for Gibraltarians and other long-term residents. It is, of course, a reflection of how much I care for and about unemployed workers whom I want to protect, rather than leave them to fend for themselves and fare as best they can against the flood of competing cross-border workers who are here as job seekers. It does not surprise me, since he defends the record of the GSB, who welcomed the massive increase in frontier workers over the last 15 years at the expense of our own people. I am sorry that he chooses to describe my efforts to get our people into jobs as an immigrant. I can say I am happy that there has been an increase of 524 Gibraltarian shenanigans and 167 other British shenanigans to a 9-month period, after I have been in reserve for just a month. An increase on what was there before, and I only wish the numbers were higher. I can assure you that given that these shenanigans have been held by the department, irrespective of their political views, many must have voted for him, but may now be less likely to repeat that mistake after hearing his views. Mr. Speaker, as regards the statement we had yesterday from the official and the unofficial opposition leaders, as to the debt and the reserves, it seems to me that they fail to understand the simple facts contained in the estimates. At the end of the financial year 11-12, the level of reserve set off against the gross debt was such that there was really no margin of usable cash available. Hence, the Honourable Member's statement in the official opening of Parliament at the time that it would support a motion to go over the limit of the 7% net debt, which is what we have planned and would have done had we won the election. The maximum net debt for the year 11-12 set by the formula was 306 million, and the year finished with 303 million of net debt, almost hitting the ceiling. At the end of 2013, the maximum debt allowed by the law was 363 million, and the actual net debt had been reduced to 291 million. What does it mean? Is it that honorable members who introduced the system and legislated it do not understand how it works? Or is it that we are witnessing an attempt to mislead people? It is quite simple. With research in March 12, shown on page 3 of the book of the estimate, standing at £230 million, only three out of the £230 million were capable of being spent. Because if the government spent £4 million out of the £230 million, it would have pushed the net debt to 307 above the ceiling of 306 by £1 million, which the law did not allow unless the motion that was being put ready in the door before the election had been brought in. The position a year later, using the same formula, is that the maximum debt is now 363 million, and the net debt is 291. So out of the 84 million reserves shown on page 3, forecast for March 13, is available, or less available, for spending by the government up to a maximum of 72 million, as opposed to 3 a year earlier. The reserves, had we spent the 72 million, would have fallen to 12 without the ceiling being breached. That is all that the figures on page 3 represent. It is nonsense to suggest that the 340 million in March 12 meant there was money to repay 317 million of the debentures, and that now we've got 84 million, which is less money, to repay 175 million pounds of the debentures, which is what we were told yesterday. The cash is only required when the debentures mature. Unless a deliberate policy decision is taken, as was done earlier this year, to repay some of those debentures early and before maturity. The way to ensure that the cash is available when the maturity date arrives is to create a sinking fund to match the expiry date of a debenture, which was persisted in the past until the GSP came along, struck it, and gave the money to coming out. Coming to the development of the role of the savings bank, it is, as far as we are concerned, an important element in support of what we want to provide to the local business community and the efficiencies that we can achieve in payment transactions. The opening of a new corporate in Main Street earlier this year was only the first step, Mr. Speaker. Today, the the Developer Service Bank has not done anything that it was not doing already in 2011 and that it had been doing throughout the previous 15 years. That is, to provide deposits in account at 7 days' notice of withdrawal, issuing bonds redeemable at 1 month's notice, and debentures on fixed term of 3 and 5 years. That is, the instruments that are available and have been available all the time. The opposition says that they supported the expansion of the bank, but have never said 2018, even though nothing has yet happened. The two specific criticisms from the leader of the opposition have been, one, that the Developer Savings Bank has an unfair advantage because a large credit institution, that is commercial bank, it is not required to have and does not have its own capital. The incredible thing about this criticism is that it is made by the very person who in government removed in 2008 the £17 million own capital from the savings bank, put it into the government consolidated fund as part of disposable revenue available to meet recurrent expenditure. And we, who are not in favor of the move, have now announced our intention of gradually building again the bank's own cash reserve, which is the equivalent of equity. The second criticism was that the expanding the role of the bank puts the other banks at risk by providing competition and taking away their customers. Mr. Speaker, if we managed to do this in 2013, we would be doing it 10 years later. In 2003, in the budget, the House was told, and I quote, "During recent years, the availability of appropriate banking services has been concentrated in progressively fewer banks, that is to say, the appropriate domestic banking services. Some people, particularly in the rural trade, find it increasingly difficult to obtain a range of banking services at affordable prices and on affordable terms. In order to remedy this and to supplement the services available in the private sector, the government will during this financial year, in 2003-2004, extend further the role of the Developer Savings Bank by extending the services and the banking program. And even having check accounts and even card accounts are a possibility. Well, check accounts for certain, ATM facilities, automatic teller facilities, and possibly also card accounts. This extension of the role of the Developer Savings Bank, the government hopes, this is all the DSB government, by the way, the government hopes will go on to correct some of the difficulties of people in Gibraltar. Some people in Gibraltar, particularly those of low-paid incomes, in fact, are having in obtaining easy, accessible banking services. Right, Mr. Speaker, that it was going to be done in 2003. This, from a party, now sitting on the other side, that accuses us of broken promises and U-turns if things do not materialize on exactly the same day and time as we hope to achieve them by. I know the leader of the opposition was not in the party in 2003. Indeed, he fought an election against him in that year. However, since he now defends and identifies himself with everything they said they did in the 15 years, including all the nasty things they used to say about me and the rest of the GSLP, I assume he is aware of and approves their policies. But in case he doesn't, can I remind him of a more recent budget in 2010? When you already had made the jump to the other side. And the former chief minister then said, "I have already mentioned the restricted credit facilities that exist for both commercial and personal borrowers as a result of international credit crunch. Gibraltar General Retail Banking needs are principally provided by two banks, Barclays and NatWest, who both provide an extensive service and have shown and continue to show a very welcome and much valued commitment to Gibraltar. Nevertheless, both these banks operate within policies relating to such things as lending criteria, risk assessment, project lending limits, country lending limits, which are not decided in or specifically for Gibraltar. Furthermore, the government believes that the market such as ours should have at least three general retail and commercial bank savings in it. Gibraltar would therefore benefit from having a local homegrown and managed bank. To this end, the government is exploring the viability of establishing such a bank in partnership with private sector interests. A project paper has been prepared and will certainly be circulated to selected private interests to test their appetite for such a venture. I assume that the appetite was not there when the deal was there. This presumably was the alternative to the idea originally of the savings bank being the standard, and yet in effect we have provided additional competition to existing institutions to the same degree as the savings bank will in future. Mr. Speaker, if honorable members opposite believe that they are entitled to accept us to implement our manifesto commitments and they are entitled to question us about any delays or failure to do so, then they have to make up their mind with their values. In this particular case, the manifesto commitment is clear. It is in the recent manifesto and it has been in previous manifestos, and therefore they have to decide whether they want to criticize it for delays in implementing the expansion of the savings bank or criticize it for going ahead with it because they are against. Having heard Mr. Speaker the views of the honorable bank banker yesterday, I have to say that there was no indication of any of the concerns he expressed when he announced what he was going to do in 2003 with the savings bank or what he was going to do in joint venture with the private sector in 2010. I can assure honorable members that the Gibraltar savings bank will proceed with its current expansion as I have stated publicly, taking one step at a time, so that its success is guaranteed and will avoid making mistakes. I do not share any of his concerns or the different concerns of the leader of the opposition. It will, of course, be run by the staff that are employed in it, and it will continue to operate as a special fund as provided for by the existing legislation. Coming to the item of expenditure in the estimate, as regards the approval for the three areas, of the estimates that I am responsible for, which are ahead 26, 27, and 28, the position is as follows. The forecast item for 2013 is within the estimate approved by Parliament last year. The budget for which I am seeking approval this year are about the same level as last year. There are two areas showing increases, one of which is where staff has been transferred from another department and where there will be a corresponding increase, and this is usually identified in a footnote, and the provision for 25LA in the employment service. This is not because they are required in the department, but because at the time when the LAs were recruited, the exact distribution was under discussion between departmental health and the Human Resources Department as to their needs. The AAs were also placed in the employment service so that the provision for their salaries could be included in the estimate and the Parliament had the opportunity of approving it. But they have now, in fact, already been redistributed to other areas where they are not needed, and therefore, although they will continue to be paid from the budget of the employment department, employment service, in next year's budget they will have been moved from there to wherever they happen to be, and their salaries will be shown in the total head of expenditure. As regards the new provision this year for community care, this is in accordance with our manifesto commitment and the policy that was in place until 1996. The government therefore has now resumed this year, the payment of an additional grant to community care equivalent to most of the estimated surplus. The purpose of the payment is to allow the charity to restore its reserves, which were in excess of 60 million in 1996, and was allowed to run down to nothing as a deliberate policy of the DFB administration. When this policy was formally announced by the previous Prime Minister, it was explained that the purpose of running down the reserve was to discontinue the work of the charity and to place current and future recipients onto a statutory scheme making comparable payments alongside the Social Security old age pension. It was stated in the public statement of the night that none of the present or future recipients of community care payments would be anywhere off. The new replacement scheme was said to be better, providing more security for pensioners, and was promised for implementation initially before the general election in 2011 and subsequently immediately after, had they been returned to government. I have to tell the microphone that found no evidence whatsoever of any such scheme being in preparation in the Social Security Department. And I'm not to assume that if this scheme exists at all, it was not kept as a secret from our members of the government now in opposition. There are no two ways about it, Mr. Speaker. Either there is a better way of helping resident pensioners than the system provided by the charity, which members opposite know about but refuse to share with us for partisan political reasons to the detriment of the pensioners, since they say that it is better than the existing system, or none of these things, and what we have heard in the past, has been true. And this was said both in the parliament, by the previous government, and they are not telling the truth outside the parliament to the electorate. Either way, I have to say, their conduct is inexcusable. From the opposition, from the moment it was announced, I invited the government to share their proposals with us, and if they were as good as they can, we would support it. From the government, from day one, we have repeated and requested in the public interest of Uberta and for the good of the pensioners that information should be made available. Not one word of reply as we have today. How can members of the opposition claim the charity is a ticking time bomb, have an alternative up their sleeve which addresses the problem, and continue to leave Uberta exposed to the danger which they claim has existed years ago? Or is it that there is no such danger? Or is it that the danger is simply their environment? In the absence of an honest and transparent response from those responsible for having put this problem in the public domain and now sitting on the other side of the house, we shall have to continue with increased funding for the charity in order to secure its long-term future, to be sure that it is not left again without reserve and exposed to a situation where a future government in terms of difficulties might not be able to help it out. There is therefore this additional provision of 35 million and the whole 45 and a token £1,000 in respect of the current year, which is over and above the 24.5 million contribution also coming for duty and the health 26, which is initially paid into the social assistance fund, and out of which the annual payment to community care is transferred. There is as well, from this head, the annual payment of £10 million repeated this year, which goes to cover the deficit in the social insurance fund. I regret to say I have not been able to bring the legislation for the fully funded Social Security Fund to replace the existing system for new contributors as I had hoped in the past financial year, and as I mentioned in last year's budget. I will do my best to do so in the current year, Mr. Speaker. I need to make clear that the new proposals will not deal with the position of the finances in the existing fund, which can only be addressed either by additional contributions from beneficiaries or by subvention from the government. What the proposals will set out to do and achieve, as I have said in previous explanations, is to contain the situation and to protect Uberta in the long term from the exposure to a potential liability which could be virtually impossible for any future government to meet if something is not done soon to address it. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Mr. Speaker. Let me issue a health warning before I start my speech formally to the Honourable Members. The speech will contain some barbed and pointed political comments. but not as pointed as those which the Honourable Minister of Employment has just deployed in the speech just given. And Mr. Speaker, this is my second budget speech, but the first occasion that I have been tasked with the responsibility of shadowing the Minister for Employment, Mr. Bosanam. And I must confess to Honourable Members that I am neighbouring on the sense of déjà vu. And I'm afraid to say that this is not a good one. Having observed the Honourable Member politically now for many years, as he knows, he is living proof, Mr. Speaker, that a leopard never changes his spots. We all would call his rather brazen and some would argue bizarre return of events statement in his first term as the Chief Minister of Gibraltar, when he said things like that he would make Gibraltar the 13th state of Europe, or turn it into the jewel of the Mediterranean, or when he would refer campaign after election campaign, as no doubt the Speaker himself will remember, and certainly the campaign before the 1988 general election victory, to his secret economic plan. I'm very sorry, I have to say, that shivers are sent down my spine when I hear him make similar statements with the same degree of confidence and bravado as he used to back then. Although I must say now, certainly the speech of the third, he seems to be slightly more cautious than the speaker. But I refer to specific examples, and that is his statement that he would eradicate unemployment by the end of his term of office. Well, this is the thing. Already we have seen lamentably on this side of the house how the reality seems to be going in a different direction. And actually that in fact registered unemployment amongst the Libertarians is higher than when the GSD left office. The figure as of December 2011, Mr. Speaker, stood at 421, with previous annual averages standing at about the 300 to lower 400 mark. The average for 2012 now stands at 522, almost exactly 100 more than the previous government had left it. Our calculations are that employment is therefore 24% higher than in 2011. The speaker who just called it propaganda, I call it a very concerning figure indeed. And I know what he means. He uses the vocational training scheme cadet to increase the unemployment figure to around 1,000. But the reality isn't quite different. And at this point, Mr. Speaker, it is important to recall the words of the Honourable Chief Minister in his only budget speech as leader of the opposition, when he said, and I quote, "Mr. Speaker, the nation has had enough. Mr. Speaker, the nation is let down by a government that has not known how to resolve the plight of almost 400 unemployed. Mr. Speaker, the nation is ready for a change of government." On the basis of the performance to date over the last 18 months, and on the basis of the Honourable Chief Minister's own test, they should reconsider their position and call an early general election. But there is more. The other commitment which we can see as we get closer to the government's midterm is looking less and less likely to be delivered. Is the guarantee cast iron, no doubt, to use one of the favourite words of the Honourable Minister for Employment, that he would be able to employ every SOS trainee currently in the public sector into the private sector. Yet, when one looks at the figures, the numbers in the public sector remain stubbornly high at almost 200, 193, I think, is the figure in March of this year. We are also seeing a return to opaqueness and the smokes and mirrors style of politics he so enjoys to everyone. Anybody who cares to read Hansard from the Honourable Member of the Minister will immediately see that nothing much has changed. We all know that open government is a principle which simply goes against the grain for him. And I do not agree with what the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister said in his intervention yesterday, that our questions are now answered. This is part of the truth. It is not that we want them to be, as he puts this on a tape, even more transparent and open. All we want them to do, Mr. Speaker, is to adhere to basic principles of open government you expect in any Western democracy. It is clear that the Honourable Minister for Employment does not share the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister's apparent love of openness and transparency, and is determined to do things his own way.
And I will give examples. He refuses to answer which companies have entered into agreements with his department guaranteeing employment to SAS trainees. This is a legitimate question, which is answered would at one level simply provide more information on the workings of one of the central policies of the government, and at another level, establish whether the concern out there, which is that many of these companies are in receipt of government work in exchange for taking on trainees, is justified or not. Let me advise you, have the audacity, Mr. Speaker, to advise the Minister of one thing. There is a refusal to provide the basic information only lends credence to and fuels these concerns even further. Opaqueness is also prevalent in relation to the so-called start-up companies, started up at number 6 or the Honourable Minister's office at Tam Rim. Only objective analysis surrounding these companies will show that what has happened is that the opposition has been successful in uncovering what the government is clearly trying to hide. We expose the existence of a company unimaginatively called ETB One Limited, and in the context of better than not, Mr. Speaker, with a registered office in none other than number 6, Hongkong Prince, which is also government employees as its shareholders and its director, one of the most vocal supporters of the governing party. One would need to analyze, Mr. Speaker, where there have been ETB 2, 3, the 4, and so on. The government then explained that this company was a beneficiary of a startup nurses scheme policy. But of course, the press release and answer to parliamentary questions on the subject raised more questions than the answer. Despite asking questions in this house, and despite the fact that some 12 companies have enjoyed the benefits of the scheme, we and the public are still none the wiser as to what the detail of the policy is. Who is eligible? Is it means tested? Is there any age qualification? Is it restricted to the unemployed or to the self-employed? Is there a limit as to how long you can enjoy the services before you're obliged to look for another service provider? And so forth. Interesting, Mr. Speaker, that the Honourable Minister for Commercial Affairs only this morning, in the context of his proposal to assist businesses, failed, as far as I can recall, once to mention his government startup nurses scheme policy. I must say that we are finding it very difficult indeed to accept that a government which has faced propensity for publicity, press releases on any great conceivable subject, for social opportunity, and proclaimed with pride the completion of its manifesto commitment, however insignificant. Only yesterday, in their pathetic pickpocketing exercise, the Honourable Deputy Minister referred to having complied with a, and I quote, record number of manifesto commitments. It is in these circumstances that it is very peculiar indeed that they should miss the chance to announce the start of one of these very same commitments. Our view of this development is that it tells a story, a sad story of the Honourable Minister of SAS, which so reached his party electoral success at the last general election. He has said himself in his house that in effect he trades the setup of these companies in exchange for the company taking on SAS trainees. A cost to the government, etc., all round. Of course, money now seems to be no object. The government is clearly nervous and shaken at the prospect that they may lose the next by-election. They knew that from word go, they started off as an unpopular government. Not the norm in our political history would show that first-term governments are normally swept in with a sizable proportion of the vote, but not this one. This is why they have no alternative but to leave no stone unturned and announce as many capital projects and or attractive initiatives that they can think of. The budget that we heard yesterday is no doubt part of that same strategy. One of these initiatives has, however, already fallen flat in its face. They know, as we do, that their employment policy is fast becoming the noose which is getting tighter and tighter around the members' neck. For this reason, they tried to spin the story too budget that there was a high number of libertarians at work and one just heard it from the Honourable Minister, much higher than the 50 years of DOD rule. They said this reflected the measure and unprecedented success of its employment practices. Nothing could be further from the truth. As I told the Honourable Minister last week, he and I had clearly very different views of the real effect of his employment practices. Well, the government, rather carelessly, if I can put it mildly, fails to mention, is that we have also seen the highest annual average numbers of unemployed Bulgarians in just 1 year of the UKIP government that there has been in 15 years of four TAD governments. And to read Mr. Speaker from the Gibraltar Chronicle headline on last Friday, what the government hails as a record number of locals and jobs has to be analysed more closely. The basic fact is that we can see that most of the jobs have been provided by the public sector, a 19.9% increase, and that there has been an almost identical decrease in the private sector and the NAB. This, on its own, creates a very dangerous precedent, which is that an ever-growing public sector, which in 1 year alone has grown by 417, will only give rise to higher expenditure, which in turn can only be serviced by the engine of any modern Western economy, the private sector, a sector which in Gibraltar is now shrinking. The Honourable Chief Minister himself yesterday attributed the reduction in the tax yield to less activity in the construction industry. Much of the increase in Gibraltarian employment must be on account of the fact that trainees are now employed and recorded as such. This creates an artificial and distortionary effect on the numbers, which allows the government to say, look at the figures, more Gibraltarians in employment, the pay factor effect that they are so fond of. The third distortionary effect, Mr. Speaker, is that the overall numbers employed, which has dropped by 3.3%, by comparison last year we saw an increase of 6.1%, would have been considerably higher had there not been an increase in public sector employment. And that is the point, Mr. Speaker. But just to drive the point further as to the artificial effect of the government's employment policy, I will make a comparison between two sets of figures. The numbers of Gibraltarians in full-time jobs in wholly owned government companies is 111 in the public administration category, whilst the corresponding figure for October 2011 was 100 and more employees in just 1 year. The total number of Gibraltarians, as you can check, the total number of Gibraltarians in the public sector has grown by 442. Speaker, we are on record as having stated that we are in favour of Gibraltarians obtaining jobs, but we object to a system which puts people in never-ending placements of the public sector or artificially shoehorns them in government-owned companies which rely on work, or those which have been created at government expense for the benefit of its supporters. The fact is that trainees are not receiving quality or any training, because the scheme is in the nature of a job placement with no real training. It therefore does not prepare our young or unemployed for the challenges that they will face in a very competitive environment. What the scheme is nothing other but a considerably more expensive version at £12 million a year for £8 million over the 4 years of the term, without taking into account the minimum wage increases of the VTS RC. The cost to the community will not only be the annual £12 million in rising fees, but also the expansion of an ever-increasing public sector. We are missing an opportunity to properly invest in our young people and unemployed by delivering good quality training, which delivers a skilled workforce which is able to work in real jobs. Hard work and entrepreneurship are the cornerstone and the best features of our community. We therefore need to make sure that a properly targeted investment scheme delivers training schemes which gives the whole community the competitive edge in areas such as telecommunications, gaming, the hotel industry, and construction. Parking people in the SAS for the effect it may have on the numbers, which as I know is now the Minister for Employment kept public, has no place in modern Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker. This is the reality which the Honourable Minister fails to see. And there are also other areas I would like to touch upon in relation to the Honourable Minister's responsibilities, which I shadow, which give rise to concern. And I will deal with them briefly. Firstly, we have seen in the area of construction training how many new trainees have been taken on since December 2011. We all wait with bated breath the unveiling of his new plans in September of this year. But in the meantime, Mr. Speaker, we are seeing how no new opportunities are being given to our young people to better themselves in the one area where proper NVQ qualification training is being provided. Secondly, we have seen how the numbers of registered employers in the construction industry have gone up very substantially from 466 in March 2011 to 593 in December 2012, a total of 127, or by 74 during 2012. But yet, in a Bermuda Triangle moment, all the construction work appears in fact to be disappearing. We are also seeing construction jobs going down by 1,436. The burning question to ask, Mr. Speaker, is whether these companies are being set up to artificially create or effortlessly use the job services in exchange for government work. Thirdly, we have been at the receiving end of complaints, and the Honourable Member knows this, from constituents who claim that they are not being trained vacancies at the ECB on the grounds that they are currently in employment. The Honourable Member, I know, denies this, that this is happening, but the complaints keep coming in. If this is happening, it can only be to ensure that the vacancies go to the trainees on their books and thereby reduce the numbers. This would be reprehensible behaviour if it were true, Mr. Speaker, because it would be denying people in employment the opportunity to do better themselves. Fourthly, we have also seen how the Minister for Inward Investment is, despite his leading claims in May 2011 that the party had investors knocking on their door, only to come to Gibraltar on the condition it seems that there was a geography victory on the 8th of December 2011. Very much a lack of secret economic plan. But the fact is that none of that has in any significant way materialized, as can be seen from questions we have been asking in this House. The fact is, Mr. Speaker, that the Honourable Minister, in his tunnel vision of life, is only interested in the figures, without realizing the potential damage he is inflicting to our young and the future prospects of the economy, and therefore our community as a whole. Mr. Speaker, some of my other areas of responsibility include tourism and the port, where I shadow the Honourable Minister of Scotland. As I have said in the past, these areas are those which go to the heart of our economic well-being and therefore prosperity as a community. The Honourable Minister is, for example, on record as having described the vitally critical economic activity represented by cruise lines and cruise passengers disembarking at Gibraltar port, which is one area, of course, of tourist and port activity. And Mr. Speaker, I simply wish to remind this House what I said in my last year's first budget address. I said this: I feel very comfortable indeed standing in this House representing the DSB record, and will now seek to make a case by reference to some statistical information which show why the DSB's four consecutive terms in office proved to be such a huge success in the tourism sphere. The Honourable Minister for Tourism knows deep down inside that he has a very hard act to follow. On any perusal of the tourism survey report of 2011, the only conclusion that any reasonable observer can come to is that Gibraltar has done very well indeed. And I ended saying, success has to be built on strong foundations, and the statistics I have been through show what can be done with this area of government policy handled carefully and intelligently. That was then, while this is where we are now. The analysis of the figures as shown in this year's tourist survey report, which was made in the House only last Thursday, indicates that the Honourable Minister has indeed found his predecessor a very difficult task to follow. I sincerely wish the Minister well over the remaining 2 years of his term, and that we will see a positive change in order. Because as much as the trend is pointing, quite frankly, in a different direction. As the leader of the opposition pointed out yesterday, that golden economic legacy which we left should not be lost. Visitor arrivals by sea are down by 33,253 from last year. In 1 month, i.e. March, we have witnessed a rather depressing drop of 34.7%, and in July, an eye-watering 41.1%, less than 9% shy of half of the amount in the previous July of 2012. If you want to raise, as in fact, as I premeditated the defense we were going to deploy this morning, the rather furious defense that these figures have nothing to do with him, and they represent a lag from the previous administration, and I'll explain later, Mr. Speaker, why that is not available to him in any event. Let me tell him that the number of passengers and the figures, as we can see in up to May of this year, when compared to the same period in 2011 and 2012, represents less, not more, than
on what arrived in those years I've just referred to. In 2011, we saw 100,915 passengers arriving in our stores. And in 2012, a slight increase of 101,545, whilst this year we are seeing 5,101 passengers less than in the previous year. In terms of cruise liner arrivals, one of the Honourable Ministers of Fisheries, and I have told him in the past, both in this house and in a TV debate, that we should fret less about cruise call numbers and more on numbers of passengers arriving. For example, in March 2012, we saw one of those eye-watering figures representing a 35% reduction on the same number of calls, that is, two calls. But going back to the Minister's obsession on cruise liner calls, here too, we also saw a reduction by 14 between 2011 and 2012, from 187 to 173. Yet, although the figure has risen slightly in terms of bookings, anticipated bookings for 2013 to 187, interestingly, Mr. Speaker, that is the equivalent level of the last year's the year in 2011. If one does a comparison between the respective positions of the years 2011, 2012, and 2013, on the latest statistics, which we take, which takes us up to May 2013, we see another different story. At this point in 2011, we have seen 67 calls, whereas in 2012, we saw 69, and this year, 50. We seem to have done considerably better in March, with an increase from 2 to 8, but reductions in all other months, notably last month, which went from 32 to 21, the lowest it has ever been in, it has been in 11 years. But even if the expected high number of calls materialized for 2013, 300,000 passengers will be visiting. Yet, with almost the same number of calls at 187, 325,000 passengers came to our stores in 2011, with 303,000 passengers brought by considerably less calls at 175 in 2009. The Honourable Minister cannot shy away from the responsibility which he has for what is a slowing down area of this area of our economy, and only attribute positive results to himself. It was in last year's budget, Mr. Speaker, when he very confidently stated that the figure for cruise calls for 2012 had gone up by 7. In fact, the number turned out to be higher than that, 13, and claimed that this was an account of the government's policy, and I quote, of pursuing personal contact and structuring continuous and fluid communication with the decision makers in the industry. I have told it in this place and outside of it that he had not discovered America, and that I was sceptical that his discovery would reap results beyond what had already been achieved by the GSD. But I was of course willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, given that he was so enthusiastic with his new found approach. The fact is that his figures speak for themselves. In the month following his address, every single month showed a reduction in the number of cruise calls, other than in September, where there was a slight increase of 3, and in October, an even slighter increase of 1. Who or what does he blame for this? Visitor numbers to the Upper Rock are also down. As of March 2013, we have seen 87,306 visitors. Yet the figures for the same period in 2010 and 2011 are 91,000, 98,000, and 107,000 respectively. The 2013 numbers are down by a staggering 19,896 from the previous year. All of this, despite the much publicized £1 million investment in our tourist attractions, and with a further £1 million allocated for this financial year. Let us hope that the figures pick up in the future. Total, and I appreciate the distinction that the Honourable Minister made this morning, but the fact is that total land visitor arrivals are also down by 113,000 from 2011 to 2012. However, total arrivals by 122 over the same year. 2013 is, as it may seem, a similar downward trend in equivalent periods in 2012, with a reduction of 585. Tourist expenditure, which is the most worrying figure I can quote this afternoon, is also down by 34.17 million, at 244.69 million, the lowest it has been for the past 6 years.
I also, the fact is that other than in air rising, where we have seen a marginal increase, we have seen reductions in all areas of tourist activity. As I have said previously, this is a trend which I sincerely hope that the government can address, and that the substantial monthly investment which it is making in this area reach benefit and reach them soon. Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition has asked me to address some of the points made in members' contributions before me on the government side, and I think they have all contributed other than the Honourable Minister for Culture, and I will deal with some of the points made. Firstly, in the area of e-government, Speaker, let me welcome the government initiative to, I think it was announced by the Honourable Chief Minister, to set up an online service for the submission of forms to the ECB, given that it's one of the areas of my responsibility. I'm sure that this is an initiative which will find favour by users of the service, in particular the business community. Secondly, let me assure the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister that we will find the opposition supportive in respect of the government's efforts in relation to the continuing inclusion of Gibraltar in EU aviation measures. This is something which I know he's a historian, and we've discussed it on many occasions before, which has denied us for many years as a result of political pressure from Spain following our rejection as a matter of principle of the infamous Airport Agreement of 1987, and it is a right which we ought to enjoy as EU citizens. Thirdly, I would want to pick up on some things which have come through after hearing the Honourable Gentleman and Lady Officers. And that is that they are clearly all on a veritable spending spree. These are ministers whose political leader spoke of a, the Honourable Leader of Opposition quoted again yesterday, serious public finance problems. This is only a year and a half ago. He painted a very, quote, bleak economic picture. How is it possible, Mr. Speaker, that they have managed to turn the tide of economic doom and gloom to a situation where they can spend as a result of their regulation or the answer is clear, and that is that what Gibraltar witnessed in 2011 was indeed a big lie election. I could understand if following their accession into office they had said, well, we now have to change direction. We have no money. If they can see what our new and wonderful economic policies will bring. And then perhaps in the last budget, in the last year of office, say, look at all the new investments which have been brought in, and you're not going to spend. No, that's not the position, Mr. Speaker. They started spending from where they, in a monumental U-turn from the first years of the government time in office, which believed in saving money. That was a matter of principle that the Honourable Minister for Employment kept on saying. Believe in saving money for a rainy day. And that was a matter of principle which wanted to say, but we had a real reaction to that. They have now become the census government policy alone. We have heard of money being spent on the settlement of the state, on new posts in the health service, increasing allowances here and there, an astronomical increase, as my honourable friend Mr. Luhan mentioned this morning, on GHA spending, where the Honourable Minister for Health rather disingenuously stated that this is the first time that the health expenditure has come within budget. But of course, I may be true, but he fails to mention that there has been a humongous increase in expenditure from an originally estimated expenditure for 11-12 of 78.9 million to an estimate for this coming year of 90.5 million. Talk about spin, or as he would put it, gyration. 4,000 pounds extra for the education budget. If the Honourable Minister for Education and most of the other areas of government responsibility, a doubling of finance centre staff, more reporters in marketing, a further EO coach in the gambling unit, new 116 bicycles for the RTP, new expensive vessels, a further £1 million in tourist sites. The list goes on and on and on and all of this simply reinforces our charge and accusation that 2013 was a big lie, or as I would put it, the big deception election, and the electorate know that this is the case, and will not be deceived. The Honourable Minister for Housing, Speaker, moving on, referred to the research which this party carried out in opposition, the results of which he claimed had allowed them to address the Gibraltar's housing needs. And that is really carelessness of language that I can put in English. And it doesn't really expect us to believe what he says. They kept on saying, time after time, when in opposition, that there was a collective of Gibraltarians which had been exiled from Gibraltar into Spain because of lack of housing here. Yet when we asked them to state how many of those poor people there were, they said there were only a few. Two or three. This can only suggest that either they were not candid in making the political point before, or the research is faulty. They really have to learn to be a bit more persuasive. I will now pick up on a point made by the Honourable Deputy Minister that we are a nitpicking opposition. I mean, it's a bit rich coming from the Honourable Gentleman. When he was in opposition, he knows that this is not the case. He knows that this is too bad. We have welcomed government initiatives. We have worked together as the Honourable Minister for Tourism has published my knowledge, and I'm grateful for that, on legislative initiatives. We have taken initiatives such as the motion on the EU vote, which sought and obtained a cross-party position on an important issue which affects us all. The criticism, Mr. Speaker, more accurately describes the previous opposition's behaviour, but not this one. Nitpicking is in fact an activity which they rather remarkably continue to indulge in, and if they, not us, were still in opposition. 18 months in, and they are still in opposition mode, or as I would describe it, DNC backing mode. The Honourable Minister for Health is quite blatant when he expressed himself in words yesterday afternoon, I will continue to blame them. If you heard his speech, and not for many of the other ministers, you'd be forgiven for thinking that the leader of the four-term government, which had inflicted so much harm on the community, should be the recipient of the mantle. But it attracted praise from both sides of the house. This is an inherent, he says, he stops right. This is an inherent contradiction in that position. But you see, Mr. Speaker, I am really concerned for the members opposite. Because they are starting to believe their own propaganda. I mean, the Honourable Minister for Housing refers to the forgotten estate. The Honourable Minister for Health now refers to the illegal fishing agreement, as if they were a universally accepted definition of these things. They are none of these things. If the Honourable Minister for Health is going to frame aid, the electoral result has been vindication for his careless announcement of Facebook, he must know that he is treading on thin ice. Because more than half, i.e., the majority of the people of Gibraltar did not agree that that was an illegal agreement which required tearing up, or that the estates which they themselves lived in were forgotten. The great blunder, if I can use the Honourable Minister for Health's words, was not the agreement, the co-author of which was the Honourable City of Aruana. Yes, the one they keep praise on so lavishly yesterday, but him for perpetrating nothing other than a diplomatic disaster. And to suggest that it only seems that there are more incursions, so there is a camera on everyone's iPhone or phone, really takes the biscuit. Why don't they have the humility to accept this, that this was the downward Bay of Pigs moment? As a speaker, just as an aside comment, I must say that I am concerned more for the Honourable Minister of Health's heart than for his weight, as I saw him rather worked up yesterday. I know that he is a good actor, so maybe he didn't mean much of what he said, or at least the way he said it. This advice, I also impart on the Honourable Minister for Employment and all the other areas of government responsibility, who in his continuous jack-in-the-box interruption of my late friend and Honourable Friend Mr. Figueroa's contribution this morning, and I impart the same advice to the Honourable Minister for Social Services and Tourism, was really rather remarkable and unbecoming, I think, of behaviour that one normally sees in this house. But you see, Mr. Speaker, the only explanation that I can find for their lamentable behaviour this morning is that it betrays a nervousness at the electoral prospects in the next 10 days. The listening and now viewing public will note that the opposition, Mr. Speaker, has not interrupted one of the government's interventions, and have courteously sat through many of the barbed and pointed criticisms which have been made by them of us. All we ask them to do is to treat us in the same manner. This is called freedom of speech, which they say they believed in at the time of the last election, when you express the desire, this is what happened in the, I think it's page 12 of the manifesto, to ensure that no one in the Volta should be afraid to speak their mind. Well, let me tell them one thing, this opposition isn't afraid to speak its mind. To touch upon the government spending program once again. People need to ask themselves this. Do they see that new investment that was promised from the end, which affords the government the opportunity to spend at the pace that they are spending? If the answer is no, they need to ask themselves, where will our tight public finances be in 3 or 4 years? I trust that no one on this side of the house will have to make the sort of arguments which the honourable deputy speakers are made as to the state of our finances, but this means the justification. The speaker said in his budget address and is quoted in today's chronicle that everything which should go up is going up, and everything that should go down is going down. I'm not sure what he's referring to, because clearly unemployment is certainly going up, Mr. Speaker. Or is it referring to port arrivals, land arrivals, upper lot visitors, and hotel room occupancies? Because they are all definitely, Mr. Speaker, going down. For all these reasons, when people are given the opportunity to have their say, as to this government's performance, although there will not be a change of government on the 4th of July, I am confident that they will be sending a very clear and unequivocal message to this government that they are not happy with the way things are going, and the government is going to pause and change of that. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, this is my 14th public speech, and from all the other members except Peter, Mr. Cajuana, and Mr. Neto, I, from that side, have done more public speeches than any other. And my second as a minister. And I'm not going to go on about the behavior in this house of either side, because it is nothing compared to the behavior that I had to endure when I was sitting on that side for 11 years. From people sitting on this side. Nothing compares. This is Mickey Mouse. Mr. Speaker, I am glad that the Chief Minister is going to round up with the budget speeches, because I would have had a few days to try and answer all the issues that have been brought up in this budget. So I'll just refrain myself from carrying on with my budget speech. Mr. Speaker, I cover a number of ministries that are more high profile, like culture and sport, as well as others that generally receive less publicity. I will therefore start with the ones not usually mentioned, but which are also very important to our community in respect of the function that they perform. In fact, I feel honored that these have been entrusted to me. As a Minister for Utilities, I cover both water and electricity as the Chairman of Aquagrid and the Gibraltar Electricity Authority. In relation to water, we are seeking to continue a good relationship with our partners Aquagrid. As we all know, this is a private company that has for years delivered water to our homes in a very efficient manner. They pride themselves on customer service that is next second to none. The company is currently looking at how we will include into their system all the ex-MOD properties that have been handed over under the 2011 land deal. The aim is to reduce the cost without affecting the workforce and the quality of the service that is delivered. This is coupled with the fact that we have a manifesto commitment of not increasing water tariffs during this term of office. The company is investigating how to produce cheaper water than we are doing currently. RL plants that were commissioned by that site are very expensive to run, since they run on electricity and produce electricity, and producing electricity in itself is very expensive. The government is also looking at how we will deal with our waste, and we are actively examining at how we can use our waste in order to produce energy. As a member of the Inter-Ministerial Group, which is looking at energy sources, I am interested in seeing all kinds of systems that can produce energy, cut down on our carbon footprint, and at the same time, save on cost. I will later on explain how we'll be able to do this at the swimming pool. In relation to electricity, it's already public knowledge that a government is going through the tender process to procure a new power station. When one thinks of the plan that the previous administration had for the future generation of power, people can be right to question where the logic in such a project lay. Diesel-powered engines that would have kept us for 30 years, costing £140 million, and also involved an increase in tariffs for 20 years of 5% per annum. We did not find out about this, talk about the sector, about this proposed increase until after the general election. We are now looking at different options with the environmental considerations uppermost in our decision making. Our aim, obviously, is also that the cost of producing electricity is reduced. We have had to contract Energy International to provide Gibraltar with enough capacity for supply of electricity until we have a new power station. I understand that Mr. Nathan might not be interested because he's the Minister for Utilities and he's not listening, so never mind, I'll carry on. Any problems are generally caused by the aging infrastructure which we have inherited, which should have been tackled in the last 10 to 15 years. Be that as it may, I am happy that the power station, which will be in place sooner rather than later, will be the type that our community deserves. Mr. Speaker, I now move on to the postal services. We have a situation in our postal services where at least three SMG single operative grade basic staff have been on the supply list, supply meaning that they were permanently, for 4 years. These officers have now been employed on a full-time basis. One cannot understand how somebody can be employed on a supply basis for 4 years and not needed. A long-standing claim that the postmen and women have had that was that of finishing goals. You can say that last summer they went on the finishing goal and that this could continue. In turn, they have agreed to maintain an official service to the public. Further, the government has reviewed the contract with Change Management Limited, and we have contracted the services of three of their four employees for Change Management Limited on an individual basis. Refuse collection is another ministry area that I cover. I can say that when we came into office, the men's depot could have been better. The men's depot was in a shameful state. Golden legacy. I can now say that we have developed a good working relationship with the men and the union and my office. Issues which arise are quickly dealt with to the satisfaction of all. Sometimes it only takes to listen to their concerns. This is a listening government, Mr. Speaker. fire service. A review has now been conducted, completed, and a copy has been made available to interested parties. The government, through the Chief Minister, as the Minister responsible for industrial relations, and myself, as the Minister for the Fire Brigade, intend to engage on the report with interested parties. It is important to note that minor issues the men have had for years have now been resolved. As to the lady's comment, I am proud to say that I visit the fire station regularly. I meet with the city fire the city fire brigade officers at least once a month, and my doors are always open to both committee and the union. A far cry from the past, the minister hardly ever visited the station, only probably when she was a young girl and allowed to go to different parties. We are currently engaged with the union to implement reforms to the dispatch system, and this will be one that will be prioritized and implemented within the next few months. I am confident that we can achieve this with the goodwill of all sides. Civil contingency is another of my roles, and I see that all the essential services are well, that all the essential services need to be well coordinated to deal with any eventuality. There is still ongoing coordination to establish what equipment are held by different services. This shows that not much had been done previously, because the people who are experts and professionals in the field were not allowed to function as they should. The new government found that the bunker, i.e. the boardroom at number 6 cellar, which had been projected as being state-of-the-art, and in which the Chief Minister and the then Civil Contingency Minister would liaise centrally with all heads in the C3 committee, was simply not fit for purpose. To give an example, there are no independent generators placed there or nearby, so a simple power cut would cut communications with the outside world. All this is being looked at now. The government are now looking at having a mobile control vehicle that can easily be deployed anywhere and where the command center can be situated. Furthermore, we have employed a civil contingency press officer who can deal with communicating to the general public, to the media, in order to be able to inform people on the impact of any possible disaster. Mr. Speaker, people panicking and not knowing what to do in these circumstances has to be prevented at all costs. As to the Honourable Lady's comment, as that I have met 3 times in 1.5 years, again, I think I would put it as a different genius or whatever, but that is not true, Mr. Speaker. She asked the question way back in February. Therefore, I have met more times since then. He should have actually asked the question maybe in this house, this last house, and then she would have been correct. The fact is that I've met with them 4 times in the full C3 meeting, 3 times in the sub meeting, which are in between, and that I meet very, very regularly. In fact, I met with Mr. Edmund, who coordinates the civil contingency, in June 2012, December 2012, twice,
in January 13, in February 13, in March twice, and in June only 10 days ago twice. Much more than the civil contingency minister did in 16 years. So there you are, Mr. Speaker. That speaks for itself. I will now move on to other ministries for which I am responsible. I guess they're my grammar ones. Mr. Speaker, on the 1st of June 2006, the previous administration decided that the Gaza swimming pool should be part of the GSLA and that the pool would be open for the public to enjoy. A very welcome but no consideration was given to the increased number of users that the pool would have. The consequence was that the pool deteriorated and hardly any maintenance was carried out. In fact, there was total neglect. It was reflected in the incident of February 2012, where the dust from the air treatment system collapsed. I am pleased to announce that a major refurbishment program is well underway, which will transform the pool for the users to enjoy. The most exciting part of this project is that the pool water, the hot water in the changing room, and the air treatment of the whole pool will be powered by the sun. Solar panels will be placed on the roof to achieve this. In fact, the most important aspect of this reform is that the system will pay for itself within 4 to 5 years, with a saving on electricity bills, which we all know are heavily subsidized by government. After this period, the investment will have been paid for and the savings will be considerable. This is a win-win for all. The taxpayer, the users of the pool, and most importantly, for the environment. We have also taken over the employees who are employed by GASA, and the management of the pool is now under the GSLA, as it should have been from the very beginning. To the speaker, the Bayside complex will also be going through minor and major refurbishment work. The Honourable Member, Mr. Regis, has asked a number of questions which relate to whether the stadium is up to standard for international competition. In fact, the fact is that many parts of the stadium and the complex in general have been neglected over many years. Take, for instance, the east stand of the stadium, where the toilets and changing rooms were. These have been left to rot to such an extent that they have been closed for years. With a small budget and using the small company of local workers, I am pleased to say that the whole of the East Stand will be refurbished. All toilets and amenities will be improved for the use of spectators. Continuing with the East Side, it was painful to see the state that the changing rooms on what is commonly known as the sector area had denigrated to. The speaker, that was constructed by the ESAP, and it was still there only about months ago. It was a health and safety hazard in the extreme, where many young boys and girls actually approached. We took advantage of the fact that the contractors were on site, placing the magnificent turf on pitch number 2, we knocked it down, and for the time being, as a temporary measure, we have placed perfect
for use of toilets and cleaning. Further works in the area will include a cover on the stand where parents sit to watch their children play and where there will be cafeteria facilities in the same area. With some of the turf which was removed from the main pitch, which was deemed to be of a good state, we have improved the areas west of the pitch number 2. Now these areas can be allocated for training purposes. Mr. Speaker, the government will continue with refurbishment or with refurbishment of all the facilities that have deteriorated due to years of lack of maintenance. Golden legacy. This includes the clean rooms which serve the old sports hall. A total refurbishment program is also underway, and it will result in not only the day-to-day users being able to enjoy the facilities, but the change will also give a good image to the many travelling teams who come to Gibraltar to compete in many competitions and have had to use these deplorable facilities. Another innovation in the Bayside complex has been to facilitate the use of what was the waste ground in the westernmost part of the Bayside complex, where the slipway was constructed. Now, not only can the canoeists enjoy this area, but also those with jet skis. The area concerned was resurfaced, water meters placed, and parking areas marked with a separate entrance provided. Another fraternity who were largely ignored are now very happy. Within the Bayside complex, the DSA has been housed on a temporary basis until the new stadium is built. Mr. Speaker, one last but important improvement which will be in place at the Bayside complex by the beginning of the new season, and which the hockey fraternity has been asking for many years, is that of having floodlights at the hockey pitch. One cannot understand how we can have stands, first class turf for the playing of hockey, and no floodlights. This has meant that having tournaments or visiting teams competing with our hockey players and the training of hockey during the winter period could only extend until the sunset, which is around 6:30 p.m. Now the hockey teams will be able to enjoy the playing of hockey until at least 11, which is the time at which the whole of the complex usually closes. As demand for more sporting allocation increases, we have to look at other facilities. The community use of schools, which I remember which was introduced by the DSAP in the 90s, we will now be aiming to extend to continue during the weekend. And I am discussing with my honourable friend, the Minister for Education, to see how we can work out around that. We are also trying to find ways in which these facilities can be used during the summer period. All playgrounds around Gibraltar, such as Hargreaves, the Laguna, the Dustin Youth Club playground, the Edinburgh Estate playground, will be going through a refurbishment program, which will not only improve facilities for the youngsters in the estate, but will also allow them to be allocated to sports in general. We have also spoken to GABA, the Basketball Association, who manage the Garrison Gym, to see how we can maximize the use of this venue. And I'm pleased to say that we aim to have this place used throughout the week and weekend, not only for basketball, but also for other sports, and maybe even as a cultural facility. There is an entrenchment block. The Lasbury Barracks has been refurbished
The allocation process was regrettably a shambles. The system of allocating chemicals was not done via LPS, who had associations and groups on the list, on their waiting list for their turn. These allocations were often made simply at the whim of number six. Some were coincidentally on the list, but the majority were not. This created a totally unfair situation in which groups and associations which had been waiting for years for chemicals were left out in the world. In coming into office, we realized that there were some areas that were abandoned and could easily be used for sporting clubs and associations. This was the case with town rooms. Rooms where many chemicals had been had been refurbished and had been allocated using the system of applying via LPS. I move on to heritage matters, Mr. Speaker. Harding's Battery, which is situated at Europa Point and was refurbished and was the part, part of the refurbishment of the whole area, has been closed since it was inaugurated by the previous government in 2011. As soon as the entire fanfare, talk about propaganda, was over, the place was shut. A few months after I became minister, it was brought to my attention that the battery, which had been discovered underneath the mound where tourists viewed the site, an interpretation centre had been constructed and fitted out with glass panels and models of soldiers of the period. We set about trying to find the keys, and I was astonished at the fact that the contractor still had possession of the site, since no one had bothered to take responsibility for this place. When we looked at the battery, my office immediately organized for the center to be open to the public. Speaker, talk about spendthrift. One cannot understand how more than £300,000 had been spent on this project. And the whole media fanfare, talk about propaganda, had taken place months before the election, yet only for the place to be shut hours later. Now, during the last month or so, and with the help of private company Besides and Mr. Richard Labrador and my office, a carriage was constructed and a 45-ton gun placed on its original position. The cost was shared between Besides and the Ministry of Heritage. The relationship with the Gibraltar Heritage Trust, continues to improve. That is one of our manifesto commitments. And not only with the Gibraltar Heritage Trust, but with other groups. The fact that the GPC is now open, an open public forum, has been welcomed by the Heritage Trust. Further, we have introduced a heritage filter, similar to the environmental filter across government. For people to understand what is meant by the filter, I would like to use the example of the new St. Bernard School. When plans were originally put to the Minister for Education, the proposal included knocking down what was the old district quarter. The document went through the filter, which meant that it was assessed by the Ministry of Environment and in turn the Ministry for Heritage. Concerns were expressed by the Heritage Trust, and after a number of site visits by all parties, instructions were given to architects as to what was permissible. The magnificent plan now protects many of the
heritage aspect of what was the old colonial hospital. That is democracy at work. At this stage, I would like to quote from the media last week, where it was stated, "The Heritage Trust welcomes the ex-colonial hospital redevelopment and the urban regeneration scheme. The Trust has welcomed the recent announcement by the government of the redevelopment of the old St. Bernard Hospital into a school and the new impetus given to the urban regeneration of the Gibraltar's old town." And it carries on and says, in a statement, the Trust says that these developments are very significant in terms of conservation of the old town. And I quote, "The hospital buildings at the site have a magnificent heritage value." And as we're going to talk about people not being in the chamber, it is unfortunate that Mr. Figueres is not in the chamber, but never mind, I took the point when Mr. Speaker said before, that some people have to go. But it's just the point that he made, on the development issue. And this is why, and the Trust is really happy at the way it works and not how he wanted it to work, or how it used to work before it was in a closed office. And it says, "The hospital building has the site have a magnificent heritage value, both historically and visually, and the project as proposed, we feel, will preserve and enhance many features of this beautiful building in the heart of the old town. The next part is where the filter has worked. The Trust is also pleased that it has been able to work with government towards avoiding the demolition of the sister's quarters at the southern end of the site, as originally proposed in the initial draft scheme for the school, and that the building will now survive and be made use for future generations to enjoy. And it looks forward to the continuing its work with government on the details of this project. It is very satisfying for me to see that this magnificent project goes ahead as a minister of culture, which includes the preservation of this place and the protection of its heritage significance." Mr. Speaker, the refurbishment of the main guard is another project that we are working on with the Gibraltar Heritage Trust. It came to me as a great surprise to hear the Honourable former Leader of the Opposition, now backbenchers, say that he would like to see the main guard as officers for members of Parliament. He was the one that, in previous public speeches, had announced that money had been allocated for the refurbishment of the main guard as the headquarters of the Trust. I wonder why he has suddenly changed his mind. Wellington Front is currently going through an extensive program of infrastructure works that will eliminate the historical flooding problems that it has always encountered. We will also refurbish the vault and will be allocating them to clubs and associations that have been on the list. And we will honour those that were allocated months before the general election and are obviously now entitled to have the place, but were not entitled before. Some of the buildings that were constructed after the period of the original buildings will be demolished. We will be working together with all interested parties to see how we can improve the whole of the northern defences, including the whole of what is known as the jungle area. This will be coordinated together with the Heritage Trust, the Heritage Division of the Ministry, with the Youth Services and all other groups interested in heritage. This is a project that will be driven by the Heritage Action Committee. So, household gate suffered deterioration to the extent that we have had to employ experts who are working with locals to restore parts of the wall. And in order to save on costs, we have extended the work to restore the St. David's Arch, which has been a project which has been on the cards for many years, and which was not tackled. We have also planned to use the Ragged Staff magazine as a venue for events, and also to be able to expose vintage cars during the year in order to attract tourists to the area. One of the areas that we are looking hard on is the application of Gorham's Cave and Vanguard's Cave to be a World Heritage Site. As you all know, this has been a long-standing project that has been led by the museum team. And as we speak, I know that Professor Clive Williamson, Dr. Farr, and Dr. Jerry Williamson and their team of archaeologists are carrying out considerable work at these caves. The Link for Heritage will continue to support the bid for the World Heritage status of the cave that will bring benefits to Gibraltar. Another of our manifesto commitments is to digitize all archive documents. Together with the Kusuma Trust and the Garrison Library Trust, all newspapers and archive documents will be digitized. This exercise will give some of the staff of the Garrison Library the opportunity to acquire the knowledge and skills of using the equipment for the future. This is a long-term project that will soon be started. As is already publicly known, the King Pastoralist Centre has a huge deficit that could have been avoided had it been organized and managed in a different way. Contracts were awarded that did not encourage the operators to run the place on a purely commercial manner. My task is to try to lower this deficit and for it to continue to serve the community and make it a place which people of all ages can enjoy. I am pleased to say that Boyd is now becoming a place which many corporates are using for their functions. We are trying to see how we can cut costs without affecting the service. We are looking at ways in which the huge electricity bill can be lowered by having alternatives and other means being linked to the main, other than being linked to the main grid. It is incredible that the current air conditioning is not fit for purpose, despite it having cost £750,000. One wonders why. The initial explanation is that the system was not one for the size of the centre, but for offices or a small commercial area. Further, the entrance did not have a double door in order to prevent the outside temperature from impacting on the interior. All in all, useless, yet £750,000 was paid towards it by members' offices. One other major issue is the fact that the outbreak is currently costing an average of £7,500 in electricity per month. Again, we are looking at alternatives in order to lower the cost, and I'm sad to say that at present the only part of the centre that is self-sufficient and unfortunately is closed is that of the gymnasium. We are working hard with technical services to see how soon we can restore can be repaired, because it is a question of the stores going wrong outside, and therefore the gym has had to be closed, and we are hoping that we will get this up and running as soon as possible. Another of my ministerial responsibilities is that of youth. I am happy to announce that the government, the Gibraltar Youth Service, will be reformed. We aim to increase the complement by 100. This will not happen at additional cost. What we intend to do
is to take on the administration roles elsewhere and allow the professionals with volunteers and part-time workers to be in a position to open the youth club during the weekend. This is one of our manifesto commitments which will be fulfilled well before our 4 years tenure expires. Our youth play an important part in our society. It is not just good enough to have youth clubs open during the weekend, but they also need to be properly resourced with programs that will empower the young to be fully part of our society. A formal youth policy is being drawn up in consultation with youth workers themselves. The proposal is that the new structure will have a principal youth and community officer who will replace the youth team leader, two senior youth and community workers, and 5 youth and community workers. All the work will be working as a team in order to be in the front line of youth and community work, primarily at the youth club. They will also act in close liaison with schools and with the voluntary sector, such as the Scouts, Guides, John Ambulance, the Duke of Edinburgh, and indeed also with social services itself. We are glad to say that the youth clubs have also seen an improvement in resources by way of refurbishment, and more will be done during the next financial year. We have planned in close consultation with all parties to improve their premises in the upper rock for the valley and to make this camp disabled friendly. It's unfortunate we need to make this one. This has been a world overview, and we will continue to see how we can do the same with other premises also used by voluntary partners. It is important to realize that some youth work is being done on a voluntary basis, in fact quite a lot, by many people. I would like to take this opportunity to thank them for all the hard work that they do. Though sport is associated with leisure, it is also true that culture also sees up with leisure. When we came into government, we found the mess that was left by the previous administration in relation to the Gibraltar Culture and Heritage Agency. I am glad to say that although it has taken time to sort things out, we are now closer to correcting the situation that we inherited. Without delving too much into the problem, I can say that the staff who were in that situation have responded in an exemplary way. We have seen how the Magic of Hall has had a major facelift. The library is now a place which many people choose to visit, and the membership has increased immensely. It is now opening on Saturdays, and has increased the service to the public. These facilities and others are now being maintained on a regular basis. This includes the Central Hall, the Retreat Centre, and the Town Range Facility for Clubs, amongst others. The staff employed in culture have worked hard in order to deliver events, such as the celebration when the DSA, having obtained full membership of Worker, and as well as helping the SDGG to organise National Day and other events. This includes the New Year celebration, the visit by the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, including assistance during the Vice President Al Gore's visit and the Mr. Walker show. This last event was a great success, despite the critics saying that the Magic of Hall was not a good venue. I can say that together with my colleagues, the Minister for Tourism, Mr. Costa, and his staff, we have also assisted in the three festivals, which is taking place in Gibraltar. This will hopefully be an annual event that will attract many literary lovers to Gibraltar on a regular basis. The Strongman competition was held in Gibraltar in October last year.
will this time come to our shores at the end of September. After the success of last year, in which we saw our very own Daniel Garcia competing and matching the best in the competition, we are actively looking at bigger venues to see how we can maximize the current one in order to be able to fit in more people. The strongman competition was deemed via Eurosport, in which we also a one-hour program on this event. This not only shows the competition, but also captures Gibraltar as an attractive tourist destination. The strongman contest this year will be the same. We are also marketing it so that people who like this sport spend 2 or 3 days here in our hotels and go spend money in our bars and restaurants. Other competitions we have managed to bring to Gibraltar is that of the Darts European Trophy. This 3-day event, which we will see the best in the world, that is the Phil the Power Taylor, Michael Van Buren, James Wade, Adrian Lewis, and many others. This competition is this weekend, so I invite all members to go to the Serpentinery and have a good time in shouting 180 when players score that. We anticipate that there will be a very good turnout in the 6th session, especially in the final day. A one-hour program on this competition will be shown on Sky Sports soon afterwards. This will again prove invaluable to Gibraltar. The Drama Festival this year has shown an increase in participation and has included groups that have competed and others who have just participated for the summer. We will work together with all concerned, including GADA, in order to see how we can improve the drama festivals even further in years to come. Our deliberations on the cultural scene are that of the devoted participation in Little Constellation Project. We are currently working at hosting the contemporary art exhibition in Gibraltar next year. This will give us all an opportunity to see and value what is going on out there in the world of art. It will also give us an opportunity to export our art and see how we feature in relation to the rest of Europe within the Little Constellation countries. Last weekend saw the Calentita event. It was a huge success, so much so the Christmas is fast becoming too small. This year we extended the venue to the bus stop at the marketplace, and even that was packed with people. For next year, we will be looking at making it bigger and better, as we said in our manifesto. Another two of our manifesto commitments are those of promoting an annual jazz festival and having a mega concert are well on the way. Now, in its second year, the Gibraltar Jazz Festival in October will see none other than Jules Holland and his blues orchestra featuring Gilson Ravitch and with guest star Melanie C and guest vocalist Ruby Turner and Louis Marshall. Further, we will have again Kirsty Almeida with her band, Ellie Macias, George Foster with his friends, and the London Jump Band from the States and from the States, Dan Moretti. We will be using different venues this year. It is already an annual feature on the cultural calendar, and I hope that it will continue for years to come. As for the mega concert, last year's huge success now needs to be matched. And I am confident that this year people will enjoy the festival even more than they did last year. The mega concert has already developed into a Gibraltar music festival. It will go on for longer this year, and the festival feel we created last year will be experienced again this year. Unfortunately, and to design up constructs with artists, we are not in a position to say who the artist will be. This will soon happen. Mr. Speaker, I would like to take this opportunity to thank all my staff and all the men and women that work in my ministry, departments, agencies, and even private companies for which I am responsible for. I know that without their collaboration and assistance, everything has worked more smoothly. Therefore, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Mr. President Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I wish to commence my contribution this year by reiterating our collective congratulations to the Gibraltar Football Association on the success of their application to become the 54th member of UEFA. Gibraltar as a whole rejoiced spontaneously upon hearing the excellent news of attainment of full membership of UEFA, and therefore I sincerely hope that Gibraltarians in even bigger numbers than in the past will support our team in all their future competitions. I am glad to note that government continues with the already existing GSB policy to assist all local sporting bodies to overcome any foreign government's politically inspired attempts to block our membership of international sporting bodies. This policy will certainly continue to receive the opposition's support, and I wish all other sporting associations, especially those like rugby, tennis, and even the local branch of the IOC, all the very best in their continuing battle to obtain the respective international membership which we all know are rightfully and legally theirs. The government, Mr. Speaker, is secondly working closely with the Gibraltar Football Association towards the provision of further football pitches and related facilities. In fact, quite large sums will be spent on projects which will be of direct benefit to the local football fraternity. These extensions of facilities carry our in principle support, but I must also take this opportunity to remind government that facilities for other sporting associations, once again examples like rugby and cricket, cannot be sacrificed in the process of enhancing only football. I urge government to be ever mindful that a level playing field must be provided for all sporting associations. More so, Mr. Speaker, as it is a manifesto commitment of theirs, and I quote, to monitor the demand for additional facilities for all other sports to ensure that existing facilities are developed further in line with our community demand. I continue quoting, Mr. Speaker, because the role of the government is committed through its election promises to provide renewed facilities for the playing, teaching and development of both cricket and rugby at Europa Point. If, however, circumstances have changed over the past 18 months, then the affected sporting bodies should be fully informed directly by the Minister and not left in a state of limbo. I would especially like to remind the Minister of Sport of government commitment to provide separate benefits for martial arts and other associations in what they promised would be one large martial arts centre. In the meantime, I wish to make a quick reference in a cordial manner so that the Minister for Sport can set it up. In his address a few moments ago, he, if I'm not mistaken, he said that the allocation of benefits within the retention block was done without any consultation with Land Property Services to actually hold the regulatory officer. I can personally testify, Mr. Speaker, that is not correct. I believe the Minister may have been misled, and therefore I am willing to discuss with him behind the Speaker's chair and even provide names of the individuals within Land Property Services who did provide the list of all regulatory applicants. That is a relevant matter to what they can legitimately say they wish to criticized the policy and the selection procedure that was gone through in order to allocate those candidates. But certainly, for the record, I wish to state that every applicant who has registered through the process that was in place at the time that was the land property services were considered. Some were successful and others were not. But that is life, Mr. Speaker. To continue, Mr. Speaker, although I am also a firm believer that individual sports governing bodies should be allowed to manage their own affairs without political interference, I urge government to take a particular interest, perhaps the correct place is with the Sports and Leisure Authority, to ensure that publicly owned facilities are used in a fair manner for the benefit of all sports clubs. A case that immediately comes to mind is the discontent that is presently brewing in respect of usage of the 25-metre swimming pool, and which ultimately falls under the auspices of the Devoted Sports and Leisure Authority. There is both a duty and moral obligation, in my opinion, for the sports opinion to ensure that, whatever desired by a citizen, membership in individual clubs and even their respective governing body is open to all in an equal and fair manner. Therefore, I again urge the Minister, in this time in his capacity as chairman of the Sports Authority, to look into this discontent which exists in respect of some governing bodies, in particular matters pertaining to swimming and boxing. I believe it is possible to resolve these with proper guidance and monitoring, and therefore provide fair membership accessibility for all sports lovers. If you see that, through collective celebration of social events, participating Gibraltarians contribute towards reinforcing our identity, our culture, our history as a people and as a community. Both the performing and fine arts fraternities always prove themselves to be very productive within their own specialized area. And I take this opportunity to congratulate all the groups and individuals who have done Gibraltar proud through their international participation and, in some cases, even to the top award gained. Mr. Speaker, through his manifesto, the GSLT Liberals adopted the slogan which said, culture needs to be nurtured. Now that they are in office, we bold to hope that this promise will be delivered. And therefore, I take this opportunity to remind government that it committed itself to provide things such as facilities for teaching of music and instruments to young people, establishment and funding for the Gibraltar Philharmonic Orchestra, run a learn and instrument campaign amongst young people, establishment of an Academy of the Performing Arts administered by an arts council, the refurbishment of the interest hall area and through which we would enclose the patio in a modern way to allow its use in the winter, and also seek to establish Gibraltar as part of the touring circuit for UK and Spanish theatre productions. I therefore have to ask Mr. Speaker, when will these projects become a reality, alongside their pledge to move the housing department out of the City Hall, and which building would then be exclusively used for cultural and historical events? Mr. Speaker, the GSC still continues to recommend that the government archives be transferred into a refurbished ex-chemical thinking works building next and adjacent to the Garrison Library, so that together they may operate as a modern, well-resourced, devoted archives and reference and research facility, including digitalized searchable data. I know the Minister has just made some reference to deeper digitalization of data, and I hope that he will take on board my recommendation and give serious consideration to its location alongside the Garrison Library. Updated legislation for the management and preservation of our heritage and the listing and preservation of buildings still needs to be completed. In this respect, work was already at a rather advanced stage while the GSC were in government, and drafting has been undertaken in close consultation with relevant experts and, of course, its role for heritage. But it is now up to the present government to complete drafting this legislation and this is something which the community hopes will be undertaken as soon as possible. The present government, in my opinion, has acted rather responsibly in continuing to pursue UNESCO World Heritage status for Gorans Cave, Banda Cave, and the adjacent sites. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, work in this respect has seriously commenced by the museum team during my own tenure as Minister for Heritage. And therefore, it is an honour for me to continue wishing the museum team all the best for the future in their ongoing excavations, which they do over a long hot summer month at Gorans and Banda Cave. Mr. Speaker, there is widespread consensus across society and political parties in Gibraltar that our educational system is both our most important investment as a community and also a justifiable source of pride for the community of our size. Given this, the GSD believes that any significant changes to our education system and to our schools should only be made after a wide basis of consultation between government, teachers and parents. Therefore, the opposition welcomes the government's recently announced plan to transfer both St. Bernard's Church and Sacred Heart Middle School into newly, purposely refurbished buildings, which were once part of the old St. Bernard Hospital. This project, as announced, is extremely similar to that which the GSC had developed through an advanced planning stage and which would have seen the light of day had we been returned into office. There has already been a very high level of consultation between we in government and the Gibraltar Teachers Association in respect of this project, and the only major deviation to what will finally see the light of day seems to be that while we would have also transferred St. Bernard's Nursery into the new site, government has confirmed that the nursery will remain in its present location, albeit continuing to fall under the direction of St. Bernard's First School Head Teacher. Projects which help to enhance educational services will always be supported in principle by the opposition, and therefore we wish teachers and pupils alike all the very best for the future in the move to the new school. I wish to take this opportunity to recommend to government that it look into, again through a consultation process with teachers and parents, the possible desirability of the following. One, the establishment of a co-educational sixth form college in order to best offer as wide a range of advanced level subjects to both sexes and also as a further means of preparation towards co-educational university life. Two, a review of the geographical distribution of our first and middle schools to better suit our changed and future changes to catchment areas. It is, Mr. Speaker, important that we plan ahead while still in the design and construction phases of new housing estates. The review should include updated assessment of the optimum locations and or relocations of schools, even the College of Higher Education, and my just mentioned possible creation of a sixth form for educational college. Three, we believe the teaching profession would welcome the establishment of an independent unit to act to assess educational standards and school performances. Four, a detailed program should be embarked upon to ensure that our less academic children, who may not necessarily follow a full range of GCSE examinations, obtain as good as possible and relevant education programs to prepare them for future adult working life. And five, greater inclusion of Gibraltar history and other aspects of Gibraltar in our school's national curriculum. Given that substantial sums of money have already been paid in respect of consultancy fees, Gibraltar patiently awaits to hear of the concrete plans for the establishment of a university in Gibraltar, and of course, this should include the range of curriculum and costs. The Minister for Education has recently said that he hopes to make announcements in this respect during the course of the year, so I shall wait until then before making any further comments in this area. We welcome the announcement by the Minister for Education that from this coming September,
students at Basel IV would be able to receive credit written so as to resist public examinations they may not have successfully passed upon completion of year 11. This would put them in a position just as their counterparts at Basel IV. However, we would also welcome the implementation of government's pledge to provide a second chance education program through the establishment of their promised National Institute of Adult Continuing Education as soon as possible. Mr. Speaker, at last year's budget session, the then Minister for Housing announced that among its priorities, government would be reforming the Housing Works Agency, inclusive of how its services were described and directed. Although I have asked for details of progress in this respect during the course of the past year, government has still not signified in a meaningful state or form how it intends to reform such agencies. All that has happened so far is that an ever increasing number of home refurbishments are contracted out to private companies without going through any type of accountable tender process. Staff members employed at the Housing Works Agency continue to be reduced. So, does this mean that what the future holds is that all the services work will simply be allocated to private contractors without being subject to an adequate competitive tender process? Will the Housing Works Agency be simply run down through natural retirement, despite the existence of an agreement with the United Union, to the effect that staff levels would be replaced in future with one new employee employed by the agency for every two who retire? The GSD worked hard in consultation with Unite to reform the old Daniel Works Department and transfer into the Housing Works Agency. This project provided brand new work sets and depots, and from its origin, delivered vastly improved services to government tenants. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, the question now is, what plans does government have for the Housing Works Agency and its employees? Like the opposition, government, I believe, knows there are many excellent craftsmen and professionals within the Housing Works Agency. So I must stress that it is important to ensure that the correct and proper administration procedures and resources are in place for housing maintenance and repairs to be carried out properly and in a timely manner. Therefore, it is regrettable to see that not only was the agency's workforce reduced last year from a total of 160 employees to 146, but that again this year there are further cuts, which will see the 146 now reduced to 139. Given the annual reduction in employees, we must ask for clear answers in respect of how would the agency be expected to carry out its duties. More so, with a promised increase in housing rental stock, if the agency is not given the human resources required to meet workload and targets. At last year's budget session, government announced that one of its major priorities was commencing the construction of co-ownership and rental housing schemes. We know from answers given at question time that consultancy fees have been paid for projects pertaining to the building of new homes, but regrettably, no actual construction of any type of home has occurred. So far, we simply know that some 1,000 homes are planned to be built and sold mainly on a co-ownership basis. In this respect, I urge government to ensure that any new homes eventually built do not suffer from numerous defects, as history shows was the case in the construction of co-ownership homes when the usual fees were elected. Quality in construction of homes should not be compromised under any circumstances. Under the section dedicated to youth, the GSMT Liberal Manifesto states that young people who are entitled to housing will not wait more than 3 years for a home. Given that there are presently a large number of young persons registered to have become sitting in their own homes, I now ask on their behalf for a firm date of when government will deliver on this promise. The opposition is glad to note the government is committed to the refurbishment of existing housing estates. The GSD was in office carried out a major refurbishment of Vallenberg Estate,
which included the roofing and lift installation, and even commenced refurbishment at Alameda Estate. Our manifesto commitment also did include further refurbishment of Moonish Castle, Lattice, and Laguna Estate. Therefore, we are pleased to note that government did eventually listen to tenants' concerns and modified their respective refurbishment plans so as to abandon the building of additional floors on these last mentioned estates. Again, I stress my advice to government that monitoring of the quality of refurbishment work becomes a priority. After all, existing tenants in rental estates deserve nothing less. At the last question session in Parliament, the Minister for Housing gave a brief rundown of measures that will be taken to ensure house rules are adhered in Mid Harbour Estate. The opposition will always be supportive of sensible actions taken by pertinent authorities in this respect, and highly recommend that house rules be revised and updated where needed in respect of all estates. I firmly urge this as the vast majority of tenants are decent, law-abiding citizens, and deserve all the support they can get to ensure that the homes and surrounding areas are decent and worthy places of abode. We are willing to work together to ensure that antisocial behaviour is stamped out and does not become the norm within any housing estate. Once again, Mr. Speaker, I stress the importance of close working with tenants' associations before any project is finalised. As members of Parliament, I consider it our collective duty to listen to what our electorate wishes for, and I hope that this really becomes a reality in respect of all housing matters. Mr. Speaker, given all government has said and promised in relation to the provision of new homes, I wish to end my contribution today by simply saying enough has been said by both sides of this House. Now, let's deliver the housing code.
We will now do so for 20 minutes. Honourable members, my attention has been drawn to the fact that a member of the public in the Strangers Gallery has taken a photograph of the stranger using a mobile phone and has in fact taken that photograph at 4 minutes past 5 o'clock when the Honourable Stephen Linares was speaking. And the photograph was taken at an angle which appeared to show that he was the only minister on the government bench, when in fact behind him were both the Honourable John Cortes and the Honourable Samantha Sacramento. Apart from putting that photograph in the public domain, the person concerned tweeted a question: where are the government ministers? The government ministers were in the antechamber, which is very often the case. Members on both sides of the House are sometimes required to attend to business, government business in particular, because the world doesn't stand still while we are meeting here in the House. I wish to make it clear that photographs taken from the Strangers Gallery are not permitted without the permission of myself, the Speaker. And that in fact, what has happened could be perceived as being a breach of privilege of Parliament. And therefore, it is not to be repeated. Because if it is repeated, any person concerned could be brought before the bar of this House. There are notices that are going to be put immediately in the public gallery, making it clear that those who are here as our guests, who attend in the gallery as our guests, are expected to switch off their mobile phone. And that teaching from the Strangers Gallery, as I say, could be perceived as a breach of privilege. I hope that I make the position clear. clear and that there will be no repetition. Needless to say, no action will be taken on this occasion. The Honourable Senator. Yes, the Honourable Citizen.
I think I'm very grateful. I think I speak for the whole House when I say that strangers are very welcome here, and that if we are not sufficiently setting out what the rules of this place are, then we must, in a way that people understand what it is that they can and cannot do in this place, but they should not be deterred from coming here, simply asked to abide by the rules that apply to, in fact, to all of us, because similarly, we are not able to photograph each other across the floor of the House or photograph, although I think it would be an issue for the Cap Committee on Reforms to consider whether tweeting from the chamber and even from the same gallery, so long as one doesn't tweet a photograph of the proceedings, is within or without the rules. But I'm grateful to you, Mr. Speaker, for having set out clearly what the rules are for the benefit of anyone who may be watching, listening, or who may be in the chamber in the future.
The Honourable James Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is a great pleasure that I stand to deliver my 18th budget address, this time with a different portfolio to the one I had last year. On this occasion, I will be covering the subject of environment, utility, and health and safety. Commencing with environment, my first observation is that I would like to highlight some of the good work that has been done during the last 18 months or so since the government has been in office. My congratulations to the Minister for continuing to recruit more staff at the Department of Environment in order to continue the DOC policy of developing existing services and indeed to be able to move into new ones as well. The good thing is that we have not had to start a department from nothing, which is what the GSA inherited from the GSAC government. Also, the fact that there is more money available this financial year to the ministry, thereby enabling them to develop further. Here, the minister should again be grateful to the GSA government for the fact that the actual expenditure on the last full financial year of the GSA government during 2010-11 was £14,089,026, something that did not exist with the GSA government before. Quite extraordinary given the constant ravaging of members' offices to the legacy inherited. It is heartening too that some good lessons have been learned by the current government from the GSA to ensure that the department continues to be properly resourced and from which to grow, particularly when the economy is so good thanks to the stewardship of successive GSA government. One such example of continuation of policy of the current government from the GSA is the updating of the Environmental Action Management Plan, which from time to time should be kept abreast of constant changes in society. This is a document that I will certainly take the time to study and, if necessary, raise any questions during the new financial year that may be necessary. I would also like to congratulate the Minister for having commenced with a program to install the solar thermal panels in government buildings. This is something to be welcomed and encouraged. The more renewable energy we can harness, the better for everyone. I do hope that further to my question on this matter, as our previous session in Parliament, we do see a more structured rolling programme for the installation of renewable energy technology on public buildings, where this is feasible to do so. Also to be welcomed is the measure announced yesterday by the Chief Minister in relation to the availability of first loans to the residential estate for the funding of projects powered by solar energy. In 2022, the very participation of staff members of the department in conferences abroad, which provides an excellent opportunity to our staff to engage with other colleagues in discussing and developing a more holistic approach to the environment globally, is to be welcomed. Mr. Speaker, at last year's budget speech, the Honourable Minister for Environment said, and I quote, "There is now scarcely a government activity of significance that does not go through an environmental filter," unquote. He then went on to say, quote, "How things have changed," unquote. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, things have changed. I do recall when the minister, in his previous capacity as government advisor, brought to the attention of the GSC government very concerned with projects due to the fact that there were birds nesting within the vicinity of the project. That was the case in the Coach Park and the stabilization work in the Cliff Base by Little Bay and by the new crematorium. On all those occasions, due to the Honourable Mr. Cortez's advice to the GSC government, the work stopped for months until the kids were old enough to leave the nest and move on, and rightly so. Today, thankfully, the new government has ticked the box, and we have an environmental filter to ensure that gang activity is scrutinized through the filter. The problem with the new filter is that when it comes to government projects, the filter gets propped up and does not work. This is what happened with the ancillary work to facilitate the floating hotel at Ocean Village. Here, instead of using the filter before the work started, he tried ahead regardless. Times have been changed, but when I raised very bold questions to the environment minister at question time, it was the chief minister who responded with evasive answers in order to provide cover for his minister. It is a shame the minister did not adopt the same attitude on this project as he frequently used to when he was the government advisor to the GSC government, without having the filter. Today, despite the fact that there is supposed to be an environmental filter, inter-ministerial meeting, and open meeting for the DPC, the environment minister has been ducking and diving on this issue because he knows that his silence on this matter has been to the detriment of the environment and especially to the endangered species in the vicinity of the world. Mr. Speaker, it is incredible how things have changed in such a short period of time. In a recent exchange of correspondence on the issue of the two protected species in the vicinity of Marina Bay, where the floating hotel is to be housed, the minister's response has been evasive. Firstly, he doesn't address the issue that work commenced before the screening report was done, lest it made public. In his latest correspondence, the minister has informed me that time planners, after having assessed the details of the project, determined that this was not an EIA project. I would challenge the NRA minister to demonstrate on what grounds the town planners have decided for this to be so. The current civil engineering work at Ocean Village Marina should either be classed as either a list one, in which case the full EIA should have been commissioned, or list two development under the town planning environmental impact assessment regulation 2000. I would therefore ask the minister to provide me with the relevant documentation regarding the town planner's screening opinion and also ask for the relevant environmental statement that should have been produced for the application of planning commission as stated by Part 2, Section 8 of the Town Planning Environmental Impact Assessment Regulation 2000. Even at the meeting of the DPC on the 25th of April, the members of the council did not know then that this was a government project. And when a member of the council asked me convenient questions to the minister, there had been discussion between the government and the owners of the floating hotel, a most annoyed environmental minister responded by saying, "This is not the place to discuss such a matter. If you need to know what has been said, we will discuss it in another place." Secondly, I know the minister might be getting a bit hot under the collar, but this is what happened. Secondly, the minister is not willing to provide me with copies of the Nature Conservancy Council, where this issue is supposed to have been discussed. I would also point out that even though his correspondence dated the 20th of June, the Honourable Minister states, and I quote, "All the necessary studies and assessments have been undertaken to date, have not highlighted any issues that would prevent the project from being realized," unquote. The public and the opposition have yet to see any single documented study or assessment backing up this claim, despite my repeated attempts to obtain them. I must remind the Honourable Minister that under the Freedom of Access of Information on the Environment Regulation 2005, this should be provided on request. In any case, what has the Minister got to hand? Also, during the government mantra of the precautionary principle on the environment, why is this not being applied to the EIA? Thirdly, in his letter, he implies we should trust his assumptions without hesitation. However, we as the opposition must insist that all relevant documents of record relating to the well-being of a critically intended business and a public to ensure accountability in the event of any unforeseen negative impact. In other words, the question what the long-term implications are of having a cruise liner docked in a small boat marina where there might have to be regular dredging of a navigational channel in the event of emergency which leads us to further questions of what environmental impact this will have. Which will a state person be permanently impaired? And who will pay for all of this? The taxpayer, the minister has to understand that the government has not behaved in an environmentally friendly way, and the minister appears to have given into the pressure of his current colleagues to the detriment of the environment. The speaker, last year I did not have the shadow responsibility that I have today. That said, there were a number of important statements made by the minister for the environment that need to be monitored during the course of the current financial year. It refers on how the government has taken forward the consideration of the epidemiological study report and so how, in any material way, it has shown any new data that might affect negatively the quality of the air we breathe. Also, what specific local action plans and focus there will be for the meeting of the European target for renewable energy by 2020. Also, clarification as to whether the department has now concluded the detailed requirements of a purpose-built environment park and so where will this be and what different waste streams will be disposed by the public. In relation to air quality, I would be interested to know if the Environmental Agency has commenced measuring black carbon and radon levels within Gibraltar and so what impact this is possibly having on public health. Another important topic in this area is the modelling result from the monitoring station on trichloroethylene and tetrachloroethylene during the risk of cancer sites and whether this information will be used in conjunction to the development of the epidemiological study the Minister alluded to in his last year's speech. The speaker, turning to the important subject of fishing in the territorial waters, it should be pointed out that we find ourselves in this situation because of the cavalier way of the Minister of Environment when he stated in Facebook that the government was carrying out the 1999 agreement. It should be noted that the idea for a fishing report was not originally initiated as a result of looking into the conservation of fish stocks in the bay and its consequent management, but rather as a tool to fish out the minister from the hole he had connected with as a consequence of his Facebook blunder. Yes, be that as it may, it will be recalled that the government has had a copy of the report since December of last year. During parliamentary questions and answers, the Minister of Environment said that the government could not provide the opposition with a copy of the report because it needed to be submitted, but that it would be published shortly. 6 months passed, and it was a result of the ridiculous position adopted by the government that eventually we had to publish the report, given that the public opinion was dismayed by the fact that the government was acting so secretly on this issue. While the report appears to represent a detailed analysis of matters as wide ranging as, for example, fishing stock information relating to these, the relevant history and EU and international convention, the important and elephant in the room issue for the public is whether they intend to allow Spanish fishermen to fish with men. It should be said that on 3 times the minister was asked by GBC reporter Stephen Lynch whether the government will change the law to allow fishing with men, and on 3 times the minister refused to answer. The GBC main and a new concern now as we go to elected opposition is that Gibraltar's interests are fully safeguarded. In this connection, it is imperative that a quick solution to the uncertainty which currently prevails is resolved without further delay. There is nothing in the report, the government statement, or the Minister for Environment GBC interview in the immediate aftermath of the policy and the report that leads the opposition to believe that a permanent solution is to be found soon, unless the government is waiting until after the by-election. This matter requires a prompt solution because, as previously stated by the GOC, there are issues much wider than the environment at stake. We have no fishing industry, but what we do have, which is worth protecting, is a stable political environment which will allow our community to prosper economically for the benefit of our citizens. The GOC therefore takes this opportunity to restate its position that the government will therefore count on the opposition's full support if it makes sensible proposals to resolve this matter once and for all. Speaker, in relation to the increase of incidents of conflict between macaques and humans, what we have heard from the Minister for Environment is more of the same quiet rhetoric that has now become the norm. On the one hand, always during the GOC funding problem. This despite that the only minister has been directly involved with the management of macaques for the last 20 years or so. And the other standard tactic is to hide behind science. One would have thought that given the minister's qualification, the fact that he has written about macaques in some books, and the fact that he has been the previous government advisor, that by now he would be in a position to know what to do and most importantly do it for the benefit of everyone whose life is being blighted with the nuisance of his father without having to hide behind expert advice. The position the minister faces today is that in his previous position, he agreed with the plan to take place as a minister of last resort. But this is no longer available to him because of the absence of the chief minister when he was in the opposition, who described killing of macaques as murder, much to the delight of animal rights organizations abroad, which threatened to target our tourist project if any cutting continued. Speaker, the reality is that culling is a necessary measure of last resort, and for many of the people whose daily lives have been blighted by this problem, it is a measure which the government should consider implementing very soon indeed. If this is accepted, as is the case of Figo, and in the UK with Deer, where the culling is in the order of 750,000, then it should be accepted here. Unfortunately, expectation has failed for the last 18 months of the government. And all we have is the hope that the new method of contraception to be introduced will reduce the population of macaques. In 12 months from now, we will see if the new method of are successful in reducing the number of monkeys, and if they are, then I will be the first to congratulate the minister. But if the problem persists, then I don't know where to meet an ask. I mean, I have congratulated. I know he's getting very nervous, and he needs to relax and calm himself down and listen to the rest of the speech without having to get so uptight about it. And perhaps show some respect to people who are doing a speech. As I was saying before, I was so rude to interrupt the speaker. In 12 months from now, we will see the new methods are successfully reducing the number of monkeys. I mean, they are. Then I will be the first to congratulate the minister. But if the problem persists, then the minister would certainly have run out of excuses. Worse than that, it will mean that through his unwillingness to tackle the problem, he will be responsible for the mystery brought to the many people whose life is being wrecked, not to mention any serious incident that may happen due to his inaction. Mr. Speaker, in relation to the proposed new permanent power station, clearly the opposition to the meeting of access to the EAE document in order to raise comments with a measure of knowledge of the subject and with some authority. Notwithstanding that, and the fact that this new station comes 18 months too late, we still have some concerns with the location of the site. We believe that to place the power station adjacent to housing estates and the airport runway is not an ideal location. The inconvenience and the potential for accidents will always be greater if anything were to go wrong. The opposition still needs to know how the government intends to transport the gas and store it within the vicinity of populated housing estates. The logical and sensible thing would have been to move the proposed station to another place less dense within an urban environment. There was certainly no reason to move away from our plans to locate it in Lasley Barrow. The speaker, on the issue of hybrid alternative energy vehicles, the government should be congratulated for the plans introduced last year on the reduction of levels of duty paid on the purchase of new environmentally friendly vehicles. This was a good initiative that needs to be welcomed, and one where we hope that with the passage of time, more and more people will be incentivized to buy this type of vehicle for the good of our environment. The speaker, in my speech last year on health and safety, I criticized Minister Valban for not developing policies on health and safety. This responsibility has now been passed to the Minister Valban, who I know is neither on the chamber nor in the anteroom to listen to my address. Judging from the two sessions of parliamentary questions so far, he has adopted his habitual tactics of ambiguous, long-winded, and meaningless answers to the subject matter of health and safety, often playing to the gallery rather than attempting to provide Parliament with reasonable answers to reasonable questions. It is a scandal that the Minister for Employment, Training and Health and Safety does not know or care for the fact that training from his flagship scheme, the Future Job Strategy, while placed with so-called training providers, what the training is, or whether such trainees do get basic awareness on health and safety courses when placed in a firm. His answer to Parliament are riddled with a racist statement, which is surprising given he has a duty of care to young trainees within the working environment he has placed them. At that week's question time, the Minister contradicted himself. On the one hand, he stated that the training centre at Blanford Bridge was closed by him when he was the Chief Minister because all of it was produced by labourers. This is not the case. What the training centre produced for decades was fully fledged. 4 years, 15 years apprenticeship in planning, carpentry, painters, and masonry. Secondly, he contradicted himself because on another question, he said that having analysed the skill needs of employers in the construction industry with regard to workplace, what the employer wants is the all-rounder training is able to do casting, tiling, and bricklaying. Well, if it has taken the Minister more than 20 years to know such a basic need of employers, why then did them close the training centre and move them to the vocation cadet training scheme which the Minister for Employment introduced when he was the Chief Minister? The speaker, now that with the previous Minister for Health and Safety, or the present one, is there any semblance of a coherent policy structure or program for the development of health and safety? Indeed, after having heard the Minister for Health and Safety, Mr. Lozano, he has not even uttered a single word on this subject at all in his budget contribution today. When I asked the details of statistics or audit conducted, the answer given is, quote, no, we will not give you the information, unquote. When I asked if they will provide the means of a company to have breached the health and safety legislation, the answer is, quote, no, we will not provide you with the information, unquote. Despite the fact that this is available in the UK by searching the health and safety executive website for UK employers. When asked if all government department authorities, agencies and government-owned companies have available an action book, the answer is, quote, the answer is the same as it was when we got into government, unquote. The Minister here is not even prepared to tell the official to send an email to a host of departments and civil services requesting to know what the situation is. A clear example of the attitude that we couldn't care less. When I asked the previous Minister for Health and Safety to introduce courses on health and safety for young trainees, moving from school into the world of work, I was told that it was not necessary to do so. When I asked the Prime Minister for health and safety, how many health and safety committees exist in government department authorities, agencies and government companies, the answer was, quote, none, as was the case with the previous government, unquote. Once again, the minister does not know what he's talking about, given that in the health authority there is one which was constituted in the previous years of government. When I asked how many cases of cuts have been done in getting to government, the answer is, quote, none. When I asked why the factory inspectors and the superintendent health and safety officers spend most of the time within the construction industry group, the answer is, quote, because new sites appear continuously every day, unquote. The irony is that such response is not supported by the new statistics within the employment survey for October 2012. It is noted that between October 2011 to October 2012, Gibraltar has lost a total of 1,426 jobs in the construction industry. Everybody acknowledges that the industry is in difficulty, and the Honourable Minister for Employment, Mr. Rosano, seems to be the only person in Gibraltar who is not aware of this. But it gets worse. When I asked the Minister for a breakdown of the hours spent by industry group and office work by the factory inspector and the two seconded health and safety officers, the Minister, in his usual way, responded that he will not provide you with information requested. Speaker, at the last Workers' Memorial Day celebrated in the lobby of Parliament downstairs, the Tribunal official in his speech stated, among other things, the lack of annual reports and statistics in health and safety. While this was being said, the Minister for Health and Safety, Mr. Osama, kept nothing he said in agreement with the words of the union representatives. Yet, when I asked the government if they intend to introduce annual reports, firstly to the previous minister, he used to say that they have to buy a suitable computer software program in order to do so. It took the previous minister some 15 months to find out that the software program is unable to do what it was envisaged to do that it would as a result of my request. Today, with a new Minister of Health and Safety, when asked if the annual report is likely to be seen this year, he stated, no, with great laughter. Mr. Speaker, if this is a new game that was promised to the electorate at the last general election, then what we have had is a continuous thick cloud of tiny Levanter afflicting government ministers dealing with health and safety, paralyzing them from any positive progress in health and safety for the benefit of employers and employees. What I will not do again is repeat my last year's address where I stated what is required to do for the benefit of health and safety. If the government is interested in what I have said, they can look it up in Hansel. What I will have to say to the Chief Minister though is for him to show leadership, remove the current minister from the health and safety portfolio and put there someone who is clean, enthusiastic and able to advance health and safety in Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, as always in my budget addresses, I would like to give my thanks to the staff in Parliament for their guidance and help throughout the year. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
I now invite the Chief Minister to exercise his right to reply.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn now to Thursday at 10 a.m.
I now put the question, which will rise to now again to Thursday at 10 a.m. The House will now adjourn to Thursday at 10 a.m.